The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, because we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. A bit later, we'll be talking to Brendan O'Brien about the international video competition 60 Second Science. But first, we're going to tackle the subject of wisdom. What is it? Why do we need it? And how can we make it work in our daily lives? My guests are Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp. Barry is the Dorwin Cartwright Professor of Social Theory and Social Action at Swarthmore College and specializes in psychology and economics. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less, and he's also one of my favorite past guests. Kenneth Sharp is the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College, specializing in political philosophy, public policy, and U.S. foreign policy. Kenneth and Barry are co-authors of the new book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. So what's your premise here, guys? Barry, why don't you start?
The fundamental idea in the book is that when things go wrong with healthcare, with education, with the financial institutions we depend on, we reach for two tools to try to fix them. One tool we reach for is more rules and more detailed rules, that is, tougher regulation. And the second tool we reach for is so-called smart incentives. If we can find a way for people to do good and do well by doing the same thing, then the system will take care of itself. Tough rules and smart incentives. And the premise of the book is that you will never get what you want in any situation that involves interactions with other human beings, whether it's a classroom or a courtroom or an examining room, by relying on rules and incentives. That what is essential is that you need people of good character. People who want to do the right thing and who know how to figure out what the right thing is. And the centerpiece, the character trait that is most essential, is what Aristotle called practical wisdom. So the book is an attempt to bring Aristotle into the 21st century.
Ken, would you agree with that? If you disagree, I'm going to laugh.
Yes, I'll agree with that. There are lots and lots and lots of examples in the book, but one of the things that had struck us very early on when we actually taught a number of classes at Swarthmore on this topic before we actually went into writing the book. But one of the things that struck us early on was the pattern in the United States of how to solve the problem of bad education by making teachers teach better, supposedly, by giving them scripted curricula to follow and by giving them high-stakes tests which force them to teach to the test, both of which are ways to use rules and incentives to get teachers to follow very strict standardized methods of teaching to get students through standardized tests. And what we found is that you can adjust those rules and incentives with fear and monetary incentives to actually get teachers to follow those scripts, but the consequence is not only often difficult or disastrous for the students. But our concern is what it also did to the teachers in terms of discouraging good teachers from staying in the system and actually discouraging teachers from learning how to use the kind of judgment they need to constantly adjust what they teach to who the particular students are and what the particular problems they are. They needed judgment, not rules and incentives, in order to figure out how best to get the students to meet the standard. So when we watched what happened when rules and incentives were actually enforced like that, and we saw what happened to teaching to friends and colleagues of ours, it really brought home to us the point that Barry made about how rules and incentives can actually destroy the very thing they're aiming at.
Well, let's break this down a bit. How exactly do rules affect wisdom?
What wisdom amounts to is judgment. It's being able to find the right solution to the particular problem that you face at this moment. How to talk to this patient, how to talk to this student and so on. And people are not born with good judgment. The way you develop good judgment is by trying things, getting feedback, and slowly over time being increasingly able to read the person you're dealing with and to read the situation and to find the right approach to the particular problem that you face. So it takes trial and error, an opportunity to experiment, and over time, slowly, wise judgment develops. When you're following a script, you don't get any of that. If you get feedback that this isn't working, it's not, you can't do anything different anyway. But right. Mostly you don't even get the feedback. You just sort of barge through the script doing exactly what you're supposed to do. And the proof of whether it's working will be the tests kids take months later. So people with the desire to be great teachers don't get the kind of practice that will actually enable them over time to at least become very good teachers.
There's a natural tendency by people who are in charge, whether they're bureaucrats or corporate executives or administrators, there's a natural tendency when people aren't getting something right to create a rule or a set of rules in order to force people to get it right. And it seems like it should just be straightforward. If such and such happens, act in such a way. In a way, it's the way that ethics is taught in colleges and in universities and in schools, that there are the Ten Commandments or the Golden Rule or the Categorical Imperative mm-hmm. or the greatest good for the greatest number. It's a rule, and it seems simple. It's something you can give to anybody. If you're faced with a difficult moral or ethical choice, just follow this rule, and you'll get the right outcome. But it turns out that that's almost never the case, because the particular circumstances, who you're dealing with, the kind of child you have when you're trying to treat all your kids equally, or the kind of accused person that a judge or a jury has to deal with, there are particular people in particular circumstances and particular contexts. You need those rules as a starting point.
So what about incentives? Why don't they contribute positively to wisdom?
Well, I'll give you an example that illustrates the potential problem of incentives. And it's a study that was done in Israeli daycare centers. The parents were coming late at the end of the day to pick up their kids, and efforts to get them to come on time met with very limited success. The teachers were annoyed. They couldn't very well leave the kids sitting on the doorstep and close the school. So the director of the daycare center introduced a system of fines for lateness that were roughly equivalent to the fines you'd get if you got a parking ticket. And the result of introducing fines is that lateness doubled.
So why did it double then?
The title of the paper reveals all. The title of the paper is "A Fine is a Price." From the point of view of the director of the daycare center, this was a fine for a transgression. Naughty, naughty parents, shame on you, you did the wrong thing.
Right.
From the point of view of the parents, it was a price. It was an exchange. In return for the service of taking care of my kid for another 15 minutes or a half hour, you're going to charge me whatever it was, and it's worth it. So what happened when you introduce the fine is you, and this is the language we use, you demoralized the activity. It was no longer a moral responsibility to come on time. It was a market exchange. Incentives don't have to have this effect, but they often do have the effect of taking activities where people think they have responsibilities to behave in a certain way and turning them into activities that are simply done for the incentive, for the compensation. So teachers who think they have a responsibility to educate children, if they start getting bonuses and other perks when kids score well on standardized tests, they start teaching to the tests. Or in some particularly egregious cases, they cheat. They either give kids answers to the questions in advance or they change the kids' answers. So here's an incentive for good test performance that actually deforms the behavior of teachers and demoralizes both their behavior and ultimately the teachers as well. So the challenge with incentives, of course, is that people have to make a living. And so almost all of us do whatever we do for pay. And the trick is to find a way to compensate people for their work without creating a system that derails them from doing the right thing. And we don't think there is an incentive system that is smart enough to avoid this kind of problem. motives compete with one another, and you're substituting the wrong motive, financial incentive, for the right one, being a good doctor, a good lawyer, a good teacher.
So you say that kindness, care, and empathy can lead to better decisions. How so?
Let's just take one of those. We can come back to the others. People often think of empathy as a nice thing to have, as a good emotion to feel good about another person. But what empathy really is a capacity, a learned capacity, to be able to get inside the head and also the heart of another person so you can actually understand what somebody is thinking and feeling. And if you're going to make good judgments, particularly in your everyday life, again, whether it's as a parent or a friend or as a professional of some kind or really in any social relationship, if you're going to make good judgments that depend on the particularities of the person in the context, one of the particularities that you need to understand is how the person or people you're working with are thinking and how they're feeling. So empathy gives you a very, very important kind of knowledge, a kind of knowledge without which you really can't make a wise judgment. If you don't know why a student is confused or why a child is hurt or why a patient is feeling fearful, then you can't act rightly in that particular circumstance
right.
to know how to comfort or advise or to judge or to help balance. So empathy, which seems like an emotion, it's just a nice thing, actually turns out to be a crucial form of understanding without which you really can't be practically wise.
What Ken just said is completely obvious to anyone who's a parent.
Right.
Sometimes your kid needs tough love. Sometimes your kid needs a hug. And there's no formula. And the way parents learn over time to get it right is that they learn their kid. And we just take that for granted. You know, you can't be a good parent unless you don't know your kid. You can't be a good spouse if you don't know your partner. You can't be a good friend if you don't know your friends. And that means getting inside them. And somehow, when it comes to dealing professionally with clients, patients, and students, the importance of that seems to vanish from everybody's screen. But it's just as important when a doctor talks to a patient as it is when a parent talks to a child.
Now we have an audience question from Skeptic Kitty.
Seeing as how wisdom is subjective and dependent on many things such as cultural influences, how difficult is it for people to distinguish genuine wisdom from woo?
Woo is generally thought to mean pseudoscientific thought, let's say. So paranormal beliefs, supernatural beliefs, those kind of things.
I see. It's a critical question that we've not only been asked a lot, but we also deal with among our skeptical students. Every time they're faced with somebody who says, well, this is the right thing to do, or we have to figure out the right thing to do, mm-hmm. we'll immediately ask the question, well, is the right thing to do an objective thing?
Right.
And the answer really is both a yes answer and a no answer. There is usually the right way to deliver bad news to somebody or the right way to tell a patient that their days may be numbered or the right way to handle a difficult situation in an argument. But it's not the right way in the sense that people mean it when they use the word objective or scientific. That usually implies there's a rule or there's a standard and all you do is apply the standard. But the great insight that Aristotle had, he was really arguing with the great objectivist of all time, which was his teacher, Plato, who really believed there was the good and the forms, and if you knew them, that you'd know everything. He said, no. It is important to know what the aim of an activity is or what the purpose of teaching or parenting or friendship or doctoring is. But understanding that objective purpose isn't going to give you an objective answer to any of the situations that you're going to face. Again, you're going to have to apply it to the particular context. So the answer to whether you know that somebody's acting in a practically wise way is usually to ask other people who are good at that activity. So people who are good friends or good doctors or good teachers or good parents, they're experts in the practice of solving the everyday conflicts in that activity. These people are people who can both teach you and who can also identify and help you learn what the right way to approach something is. But when we do this in our class, Desiree, it's fascinating. We have two or three classes that we open with our students writing essays about incidents in which they've had fights with their friends or settled conflicts with their friends or what a best friend is. In those classes, the students talk with each other for hours, figuring out the right way to do the right thing in terms of and arguing about it. It's not simple. It's difficult to figure out what it is. But the one thing that they never say when they're dealing with friendship is, who are you to know what the right thing is? They know that there's a better and a worse, even if it's not the right, a better and a worse way to handle things. And when it's posed like that, instead of what's the objective good, they'll actually sit down together and work it out to try to figure out what the best way to handle a problem is. The one thing they won't say is, oh, whatever.
But, you know, the question is actually a very, very deep question that applies far beyond just our book. Aristotle made the point that it is a big mistake to use a measuring instrument that is more precise than the thing you're trying to measure. And his argument, you know, if you're measuring the distance between planets, you should use as precise a measuring instrument as you can. But if you're trying to measure how hurt or how angry or how afraid someone is so that you know how to interact, that's not a precise enough thing for there to be such a measuring instrument. And the reason why I think this is an important thing for people to understand is that we consistently in society measure things precisely even when we know they are not the most important things to measure, just because we can measure them precisely. So we measure GDP as a sign of a society's health because we can. And all of the aspects of quality of life in a society that GDP doesn't capture, we don't worry about,
right?
Because we can't measure them precisely. So you measure what you can and pretend it's what's important instead of trying to figure out how to measure what's actually important. And Aristotle was really trying to, I think, hold people's feet to the fire, that the idea is to make sure that the main point remains the main point and you do the best you can with things that are inherently imprecise, though certainly not woo.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We'll be right back with more practical wisdom with Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guests today are Barry Schwartz, professor of psychology and author of The Paradox of Choice, and Kenneth Sharp, professor of political science at Swarthmore College. They're discussing their new book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. So the last time that you were on the show, Barry, you and I were discussing your book, The Paradox of Choice. Now, after the show, I received emails telling me that what you were talking about wasn't really science. So if we could just head this off at the pass this time, where is the evidence for all of these positions? Are you looking at psychological studies and such?
Well, the different arguments in the book, we rely on different kinds of evidence. So one kind of argument in the book is that social institutions we deeply need to work well are broken. And the kind of evidence that we cite to make that point are largely cases. The financial collapse is obviously a vivid recent case, mm-hmm. but at least in the U.S., the grotesque failure of our educational system to educate our students is salient. The dissatisfaction of patients with their health care and of doctors with the way they have to practice is salient. There is no survey research that we rely on. We rely instead on detailed descriptions of particular episodes that cover a wide range of different circumstances. We make another argument in the book that people are, quote, born to be wise, which is to say that we have, all of us, the cognitive and emotional capacity to develop the kind of moral skill that Ken and I are talking about. And that relies on 30 years of research in cognitive psychology and cognitive neuroscience. The stuff I was talking about before, about how incentives can undermine people's motivation to do the right thing, comes from 25 years of research in psychology laboratories. So everything we say is based on evidence, and much of what we say is based on evidence that at least the people gathering it think counts as scientific evidence.
I would just add that we tried very hard in the book to make all the points that we were making by using the kind of evidence Barry was talking about and the cases. So the book isn't a preachy book that kind of wags its finger at people and says, this is what Ken and Barry think you ought to do. It's a book that actually looks at particular stories and cases and evidence of why it is that the failure to be able to balance conflicting goods, or the failure to be able to know how to do the right thing in a particular context, really can screw things up for you as a parent or a doctor or a teacher or a colleague or a friend. So we actually show what the consequences of not having practical wisdom means. And part of that argument is that wisdom isn't just something for sages. This is not just something for Mahatma Gandhi or Nelson Mandela or the Buddha or Dumbledore in the Harry Potter series. This is actually something that Ron and Hermione in the Harry Potter series and Harry need. It's something that we all need in our everyday lives. So we're trying to take wisdom, the halo off of wisdom, and take it down from the mountain and show why everyday folks like ourselves actually need it, show it with examples, in order to be able to do well in our lives. And it's not just doing well in our everyday lives, but it's actually a crucial ingredient for us if we want to be happy, if we want to have the kinds of relationships that make us happy.
As your listeners may know, there's been a kind of explosion of research in the last 15 or 20 years on the determinants of happiness for people.
Right.
And I would say a quick and dirty summary is that the two absolutely essential components of happiness, these are not the only ones, but they're very important, are good close relations with other people and work that is engaging and meaningful. What we argue in the book and present evidence to support is that you can't do your work well and you can't have good social relations unless you have practical wisdom. Now, this is true, I think, of all social relations. It's not true of all work. There are certain kinds of work that are essentially done in complete isolation from other people. But most of the work that we do involves interactions with other people, and that work cannot be done well unless you're wise. And so, in that sense, the secret to happiness, meaning the secret to meaningful and engaged work and close social relations, is this thing that Aristotle and we call practical wisdom. What's encouraging about that is that it means that once people start appreciating the significance of nurturing and cultivating wisdom, it can create a kind of positive feedback loop, because if you become wiser, you do your work better and you get more satisfaction out of it. You wake up every day with a smile on your face. Your social relations go better, and you get more satisfaction out of them. You wake up every day with a smile on your face. So you're more and more eager to use these skills, this judgment that we're talking about. And once it gets started, it then can perpetuate itself, or at least that's what we suggest.
So in some sense, the proof for the skeptic is try it, you'll like it, right? If you start learning how or appreciate how you may already be exercising good judgment in your everyday life and learn how to do it better, your work and relationships will actually go better and you will actually be happier. And that's ultimately the kind of evidence that I think matters.
This is really on two levels. There's the interpersonal relationships, but then there's also the institutional level.
And exactly.
Have you both heard of the book, The Checklist Manifesto?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So for those of you who haven't heard of it, it's based on a concept from the aviation industry. It's a checklist, the kind that pilots would use to clear their planes for takeoff. So that idea was adapted in an experiment at Johns Hopkins ICU to see if a checklist would help decrease the rate of infections at the hospital. So doctors, monitored by nurses, followed a very common sense checklist containing things like wash your hands. That's how common sense we're talking. And within 1 year, the central line infection rate had dropped from 11% to zero. So you don't want to take away rules altogether, I assume.
No. And I'm really delighted that you brought this up. You'll notice, though, that following a checklist to keep the operating theater sterile, none of that involves interactions with other people. And certainly it doesn't involve interactions with other people to make sure that your plane is ready to fly. By all means, have a checklist. The guy who wrote that book, Atul Gawande, Checklist Manifesto, had a piece in the New Yorker a couple of months ago talking about how some doctors in inner city clinics found ways to reduce dramatically the use of medical services by very high use people, people with multiple chronic conditions who were costing sometimes several hundred thousand dollars a year in hospital and other medical bills. And they reduced the cost of caring for these people and improved the quality of care. They did it by finding ways to interact with these people so that they actually change the way they live their lives. And that required getting to know these people well enough to understand what kinds of suggestions and interventions would actually be effective. So their view was you find people who are wise and then you teach them the medicine they need to know. The hard thing is to have people who know how to relate to other people. And then you get somebody who weighs 400 pounds and smokes and drinks and doesn't take his meds, slowly over time starting to cook his meals, quitting smoking, quitting alcohol, losing a lot of weight, and getting substantially healthier and dramatically reducing his visits to the emergency room. All of this, there ain't no checklist for. Everybody knows the checklist. Lose weight, exercise, don't eat fat, don't smoke, don't drink. You can hand somebody a mimeograph sheet of paper who comes into your office with diabetes and heart problems and say, you know, follow these rules, you'll be fine. And, you know, the person will be dead in a month. So we know what the checklist have on it,
right.
But checklists don't work. And this is the medical problem in the industrialized, affluent world. It is managing chronic conditions. And you will not manage chronic conditions without cooperation from patients. And you will not get cooperation from patients with checklists.
The doctors that Gawande studied, for example, in Camden, New Jersey, what they did was to organize small clinics outside of the emergency room hospital system, and they put together teams which included nurse practitioners and social workers as well as docs, and they started visiting the houses of the people with these chronic problems, and they looked at how this particular person lived and the kinds of particular combinations of medicines this person was taking and the kinds of difficulties this person had in getting around and in getting care of a certain kind. And then they designed, working with this person, a particular healthcare program for this particular person. And then they didn't just leave the house. They went back every day and then every other day and then once a week to work with the patient, sometimes even bringing in services that the patient needed, in order to help the patient change the behavior problems and get on the right kinds of dosages of medicine. So it was a very intense working with a particular person, given their circumstances, the opposite of a checklist. And it cost half the price and was far more successful than having these people in the emergency rooms every few days. So again, it's the kind of example we were talking about before, about how encouraging doctors to exercise and use judgment to figure out and help people get the right treatments is different than a checklist in an emergency room or even a checklist of best practices.
Desiree asked about institutions. You might ask, how much of the medical training that docs get includes this sort of learning how to get inside the hearts and minds of patients? And the answer is none. In fact, research has been done that shows that medical trainees are at their maximum empathy the day before they start medical school.
Really?
It's all downhill from there. And Ken and I write in some detail about a couple of programs at very elite medical schools in the U.S. that are actually trying to change the model of medical education so that these sorts of moral skills become part of the medical training rather than being excluded from it. It's too soon to tell whether they will actually both produce better quality care and more economical care, but we're quite hopeful, and the students who are in these programs are just love them.
This point about the decline of empathy also underlines your institutional point, because it shows how institutions can corrode wisdom. The research that Barry was talking about, which was done by teachers and professors in medical schools, they gave students surveys and asked them detailed questions which got at their level of empathy. And as Barry said, it declines after they start medical school, and it particularly declines in the third year, which is when they go out of the classroom into the wards of the hospitals. And one of the reasons why it declines is the ways in which the students are mentored and the kind of models they see in the hospital emergency rooms with overworked doctors who don't have either the time for the patients or particularly the time for the students. So what the students learn by watching these doctors and by running around to rooms every couple of minutes to see a new patient and then never following up on the patient because it's not about aftercare, it's just about the hospital experience, is that over time in the 14-hour days with that lack of mentoring and modeling under those kinds of time pressures, the students actually get the empathy squeezed out of them and they start thinking about the patients as objects rather than subjects. So these programs that we were mentioning at places like Harvard and also at the medical school in, I think, to the University of South Dakota and in California and San Francisco's, the University of California San Francisco Medical School, these are all programs which are designed to change the institutional structures in order to literally encourage empathy, and the doctors will say, to stem the moral erosion of students.
Okay, I'm depressed. Honestly.
Well, the good news are programs like the ones we just mentioned, that there are medical schools that are actually trying to change that in the way they're teaching. The good news is that there are actually hospitals, the Mayo Clinic in the United States is one example, that have tried to reorganize themselves to actually encourage the kind of character and judgment on doctors which allows them to relate to patients in ways that will actually get good treatment. And you can see that. We've got examples in the book of law firms that have turned themselves around to stop corroding the wisdom and character of lawyers, of school systems and schools that have tried to do it. So to come back to your institutional point, there are ways that institutions can be reorganized which encourage the character and wisdom of the practitioners and become much better at the things that the institutions are designed to do. It's not beyond human capacity to fix things, but you've got to keep your eye on the ball and the kind of training that's needed. And to go back to what we were saying at the beginning, if all you're thinking about is efficiency through rules and incentives, and you're not thinking about other ways to get efficiency through judgment and better care, you're not going to get it.
A very famous economist said about a century ago, he asked the question, what does the economist economize on? It was a rhetorical question, and his answer was, the economist economizes on love. And what he meant is that if you set up the right system, people don't have to care about other people's well-being, because things like competition will make completely self-interested people end up serving the interests of others. So love is in short supply. Let's see if we can come up with a system that doesn't need love. And we have spent 100 years working on such a system, and what we have discovered is that you can't set up a system that works without genuine care and concern on the part for the welfare of others. And the good news is that I think we may finally have learned as a collective that we need to be oriented in a different direction than the magical direction that the technocrats thought would solve all of our problems. So these programs that are popping up are not popping up by accident. They're popping up because people are deeply dissatisfied with what they've got, and we think that they're actually turning as a result in an extremely hopeful direction. And as I say, the preliminary evidence is very encouraging.
I have some audience questions here. This question is from KD.
Shouldn't the power of the decision maker affect how closely their decisions should be regulated? Doesn't it make sense to have stricter guidelines for the actions of powerful entities such as multi-billion dollar global corporations, or for people like doctors whose decisions are routinely about life and death?
Yes. The answer is, if you don't have regulations for powerful people and less powerful people, you're going to get chaos. I mean, if you want to go back to maybe the world's favorite children's story right now, of Harry Potter, if you didn't have rules at Hogwarts, where Harry and Hermione and Ron went, that kind of British model public school, without the rules and incentives, there would be chaos. That's absolutely right. But if you want to save wizardry and you want to get good wizards, you have to be able to teach those three kids how to exercise good judgment. So you have to protect them from the rules at times, which is why Dumbledore gives them the invisibility cape, so that you can actually teach them that it's not just rules and incentives, but how to exercise judgment when the rules and incentives fail. So it's getting the balance correct. That's a great question that KB answered, because if you look at the banking system, again, you know, the source of this crisis was not Canada. The source of this crisis was us in the United States. If you look at this banking system, you had in a number of banks, we actually have the case of IndyMac, which is one of the first banks to fail in the United States. You had mid-level people that were underwriters writing mortgages for homeowners who were actually saying no to mortgages because they felt that the people could not pay and they would be in trouble if these mortgages were given. And these were professional underwriters who knew what a good mortgage was. And their bosses at IndyMac were overriding them because they said, we really don't care whether these good mortgages are good mortgages or not, because we're going to securitize them and we're going to sell them on the market and they'll be somebody else's responsibility. So in a way, the company's greed and lack of regulation, lack of policy regulation by the Fed and the banking regulators inside the United States allowed the corporate executives at IndyMac to get away with these practices, which actually overrode people who were actually trying to do the right thing. So you got to have a system of rules and regulations. It's just that you can't depend on those to solve the problems, and you have to be careful when you institute those rules and regulations that you don't try to micromanage the activities of every doctor, teacher, or underwriter, or else you're going to get chaos also.
Now, I have a question from Lee in Winnipeg, and this is directed to Barry.
I'm a big fan of your work. How has your research on choice affected your study of wisdom?
Well, thank you very much for your kind words, Lee. And actually, the paradox in my work is that the choice book is all about how we have too much choice, and the wisdom book is all about how we have too little.
Right.
So another way of saying this is that we have devoted an enormous amount of time, energy, and treasure to giving people all kinds of choices that are trivial, like what kind of cereal to buy. And we have created a system of regulations that are designed to deprive people of the choices that are essential. So you could say that my life work, or at least in the last 15 years or so, has been to help people understand what the choices are that really matter. And that what really matters more than anything else is how people interact with one another. And for that, you need freedom, autonomy, and the opportunity to choose. And the wisdom book is all about what making wise choices would look like, and how people learn how to do that. And the choice book was all about how instead we're choosing toothpaste, cars, and jeans.
Do you think the big problem is that our society has issues with nuance?
Speak for yourself.
Well, honestly, because these
no,
are
you
these
get
are
the
all
nail on the head.
United States is the land of nuance. Come on, don't you? Yeah, that is
I
a very
that.
Big problem. But I think there's a reason why there's a problem with nuance. And I think there is a kind of deep distrust among citizens of one another and of their institutions. We have come to expect the worst out of everyone. And so instead of hearing somebody we disagree with a sympathetic ear and trying to extract how it could be that a reasonable person could believe something so different from what I believe, mm-hmm. our immediate impulse is to savage, trash, and destroy. We don't start out an interaction sort of with a charitable assumption. We're all trying to make the world a better place. We're all trying to live decent lives. Reasonable people disagree. Let's see if we can find a meeting of the minds. So if you started with that kind of an assumption about the other people you interacted with, then I think you would invite nuance. People wouldn't be afraid to have nuanced conversations because they wouldn't worry so much that somebody was going to shut them down the first time they said something that was at all disagreeable. But that's certainly not the world of American public life these days. And the impression I get by long distance is that things are a little bit more civilized in Canada, but I'm not completely sure that that's true.
You guys are contagious. I will tell you that right now. It's
yeah,
spreading slowly.
I was afraid that that was the case.
I have to say, having lived on and off for a number of years in Vancouver, that just in the everyday conversations I've had, not just at the university, but with normal people who aren't academics, mm-hmm. there's much more nuance and much more subtlety and actually much more willingness to trust and have a discussion. And however bad you think Canadian politics are getting or have gotten, they don't come close to what we're going through in the United States right now in terms of an inability to have wise or nuanced conversations. But I think that you're bringing up the word nuance is really a critical piece of it, because nuance indicates that there are shades of gray. Things aren't just black and white, and it's figuring out which shade is appropriate in any particular case that's so important for judgment. So teaching people nuance, in some sense, is almost synonymous with teaching people good judgment or teaching people one of the kinds of characteristics that they would need to have in order to understand good judgment.
Well, then let's continue on with that idea. How does one teach that then?
It's easier to say how one doesn't teach it. One doesn't teach it didactically. You can't have a class on wisdom, the result of which is that everybody is wiser than they were when the class started. We think that mostly the way people learn to be wise is by watching mentors who are further along in the process than they are, making their own feeble efforts to use their judgment and getting corrected either by experience, by what happens, or by mentors who are looking over their shoulders to make sure that nothing terrible happens. So you need to operate in a safe enough space that you're allowed to experiment and you're allowed to make mistakes, and you need to have somebody watching so that when you do make mistakes, the mistakes get corrected.
Right.
That constellation of things, sort of a master-apprentice kind of relationship, is the way you develop the moral skill that we're talking about. Developing the moral will, that is the desire actually to do the right thing, to do right by your patients, your clients, or your students, that's a different matter. Where does that come from? How do you nurture and sustain that? I'm sure the answer to that is not simple. And I think here, too, institutions play an enormous role. You feel like a sucker if you're out to do the right thing and everyone around you is trying to take advantage of other people. So you need to have a sense that you are part of a communal project, the aim of which is to do the right thing, whether you're a hairdresser or a hospital custodian or a doctor or a lawyer. There's a goal that's built into those activities, and you want to see people who aspire to achieve those goals that are appropriate to each of those activities.
Kenneth, anything to add?
I'm thinking of examples at two different levels. Well, one is an example about we were recently reading about a problem in the United States at recesses in schools, at public schools, in which a recess is being eliminated because the kids weren't playing anymore outside. They were fighting or brawling or didn't know how to play, and the teachers didn't know what to do, and they were tired of monitoring them, which seems like the bad news part of this. But the good news part of this is that there are organizations, nonprofits that have been organized, which have been going into schools, one called Playmates, for example, which I think is out of Oakland, California, which is manned by college students who have learned how to teach kids how to play. They come into the schools. I've got 300 different kinds of kickball and jump rope and hopscotch and other games to play at school breaks. And they actually don't assume that kids know how to settle disputes on the field or how to organize games or how to play them. They teach them how to play them, and then they teach them how to invent their own games. And they do it in part by playing with them, by mentoring and modeling things for them. And what the kids learn by watching these coaches that are working with them at the at recess time is they actually learn different ways to settle disputes. They learn how to work together, how to talk with each other, how to obey the rules, but also how to invent new rules for games. But they learn this by watching, by practicing, by trying, by failing. And this program has been extraordinarily successful. It's turned schools around in terms of the playgrounds, and it's had an incredible impact inside the schools, too, on the way kids deal with each other when they run into conflicts or have to do activities together. But again, it's through the exact kinds of techniques that Barry was mentioning that you can actually use something as simple as play to teach kids character and judgment and have a huge impact on their lives. So it can be learned. It's just not something you can teach people in the simple sense of here's a bunch of rules. You got to actually work with them doing the practice.
Well, as usual, we can learn a lot from kids.
Absolutely.
Barry, Kenneth.
And unfortunately, kids learn a lot from us, too.
Barry, Kenneth, you are both lovely. Thanks very much for being here.
It was a pleasure talking with you, Desiree.
You can find Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp at the links on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Brendan O'Brien from the International Science Video Competition 60 Second Science after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, researcher and Scientopia blogger Cy Curious returns to discuss the fact and fiction of mobile phones. What effect do they have on brain cells? What about sperm cells? And do they have anything to do with declining populations of bees? And we're joined by medical physicist Dr. Mark McKenzie to discuss the science of microwave radiation. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'm here with Brendan O'Brien, organizer of the International Science Video Competition, 60 Second Science. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Brendan.
Thank you very much, Desiree. It's a pleasure to be here, and hello to everyone out there listening.
So let's start with the basics. What is 60 Second Science?
60 Second Science Video Competition is a challenge for people worldwide to create a short video which explains their understanding of the world. The video can only run for 60 seconds, and I've got some wonderful cash prizes and lots of divisions that people can go into depending on where they live and their age, whether they're a student or a non-student. And after they've created their video, they upload it to the website. They see what other people have done, and a wonderful range of judges from all over the world, they look at them and evaluate them, and we award prizes to the winners.
That sounds sort of simple, right? You just make a minute-long science video. But what exactly are you looking for? You're looking for an explanation of a concept?
It began as a competition in 2007 in a small country area where we challenged school children to make a video to explain an experiment they were doing. So the emphasis was on explaining the science. And initially we got quite a few entries where people put the Mentos inside the Coke bottle and watched it make an explosion. And that was good for its time, but the students didn't really explain what was going on. They certainly enjoyed the phenomena. So the competition now is quite explicit. We want people to go to the trouble of observing the world around them. If they're students, again, they can do experiments or can design their own experiment. They explain a phenomena in 60 seconds, and 60 seconds isn't long, but all the winning videos from last year, they have particularly clear thought lines going through them, and so it's not about just whiz-bang science. It's about people thinking clearly and explaining what they see in their world.
So how hard is it to explain a concept in that amount of time?
It is difficult. The first iteration of this competition was actually 30 seconds, and we found that 30 seconds wasn't enough time to nail it. But certainly 60 seconds is well and truly a nice time to explain succinctly what is going on. And it's a lovely format because it means small file sizes. It doesn't take that long to film and edit, and it can be uploaded easily, even for people who are bandwidth impaired, like myself. I live in a little country or near a little country town, and I've got very slow bandwidth out there. So I tend to do most of my work on the internet from work where I've got good bandwidth.
So now, last year, the competition was only open to primary and secondary students in Australia. So this time around, you've expanded it quite a bit.
Yes, we had such a strong response. We had 350 entries last year. And so with some urging from the National Science Organisation here in Australia and my Lords and Masters down in Melbourne, I've been encouraged to make it a global competition. So we've created quite a few divisions. The Australian one is certainly running again, and we've got a couple of wonderful Australian judges to process those videos that are uploaded. The divisions we've got in Australia are for students and for non-students and for people who speak a different language other than English. And in the international division, which will apply to all of your listeners over there in the Northern American continent, they can be open, that means any age, or they can be school students, once again, elementary or high school or college students, or they can be speakers of a native language or any particular language, and they can create their 60-second science video and put subtitles down the bottom in English so that they can reach a wide audience in their native tongue.
So why did you decide to expand the competition beyond students?
Well, that was the urging of a national science organisation here in Australia. Citizen science education is particularly important in this day and age because we've got a lot of scams. There's a lot of conning of the public by unscrupulous people who peddle a lot of things dressed up of science, which isn't actually science. It's actually what we call pseudoscience, and it's absolute rubbish, and it rips people off. So our theory is that if we all do a little bit, we can sort of counter this sort of rubbish, and the competition is hoping to do its little bit in broadening the understanding of the way the world works to a very wider audience that we've currently got.
You are speaking my language, sir.
Very good.
Now, to make sure all of these videos get watched, you've had to recruit a number of judges both in and out of Australia, and I am very happy to say that I'm going to be one of them.
We've got some wonderful judges from the UK and from the North American continent. We're looking for these judges to bring their experience and encourage people from all ages to create a short video, upload it, and then share it around on this website.
People have to impress the judges on a number of levels then. This is not just about science. This is also about production values.
Oh, yes. Just pointing the camera at something is just not good anymore. We're all sort of video junkies. We've watched so many videos in our time that we like to be visually stimulated, and so we're challenging our young and new filmmakers and experienced filmmakers to think about the choice of shot, get the lighting right, get the sound right, edit it very briskly, get the framing right, excite your audience by using a variety of angles, all of those things that Alfred Hitchcock does in his movies. If you did all of them, you'd have a winning video for sure.
So right now there are two deadlines that people should know about. Tell us about those.
We like to get the videos uploaded by the 28th of October. So people first need to register by Friday the 16th of September and then upload their videos by the 28th of October. Now, it's mid-May now, your audience will have 5 months to create a short 60-second video and upload it. Now, that is very doable. For people who are not in a school situation, they could do it very easily. For school children, about a term and a half is about right. So if people got to it now, they would be well and truly ready by October to upload their video.
Well, I do know that there are quite a few teachers and professors that listen to this show. So remember, guys, you can make this a class project. I would love to see that.
One of the things that we're trying to do here is to get science teachers to have a broader range of teaching strategies and pedagogies. And so here in Australia, at one of our universities, entering the competition is a compulsory activity for the trainee science teachers. So they have to create a video themselves so that next year when they go out into the classroom of science teachers, they'll be able to do a bit more than ask the kids to read a chapter in a science book and answer the questions at the back. They'll be able to do more than get the children to do an experiment and write up the traditional prac report. They'll be engaging the students using modern technology, lovely little flip cams and webcams and video cams, technologies that students are very comfortable with and really enjoy using. So we want to see more engagement happening in our science classrooms as well.
And it's not just about engagement. That's really about critical thinking.
Oh, yes, because what we've found is the students that are doing the filming and doing the editing and setting up the experiments, because they often have to repeat it several times, they're getting a really deep understanding of the concepts they're dealing with, and they're walking away not only with the excitement of doing great science, but also with a deeper understanding of the concepts that they're trying to explain.
Fantastic. I would love to see any entries from people that listen to this show. I hope to encourage you throughout now till September to get you up off your butt and submitting a video. Because I've seen
some of your
videos out there, and they're wonderful, and I think they should be submitted. So thank you very much, Brendan, for being here. And thanks for asking me to be a judge. I'm really honored.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to watching all of those North American continent entries coming in.
For more information about the rules, the deadlines, tips on creating your video, and a gallery of last year's winners, visit them online at 60secondscience.net. And you can find a link to 60 Second Science on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. One more thing. There's a new website I wanted to mention called Skeptics on the Net. They say they aim to be the premier directory for the many skeptical blogs and podcasts on the internet, and they look like they're well on their way. They're trying to make it easy for anyone who's just starting to learn about skepticism to find accessible resources. And for those of you who've been around for a while, maybe your new favorite blog is only a click away. So if you like what we do on the show and you're looking for more online skeptical offerings, do check them out. Their website address is skepticsonthe.net. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.